This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Bernie Mac, star of the Fox sitcom The Bernie Mac Show, is also starring in the new film Mr. 3000. He plays Stan Ross, a retired baseball superstar who left the game after earning his 3,000th hit, but in his retirement he finds out an error was made, and he's three hits shy of that milestone record. So, nearing 50, he comes back to the game and his hopes of being voted into baseball's Hall of Fame.
I know for a fact I can depend on you all to bring me Stan Ross to Cooperstown. I can hear you say, Stan! Say, Stan Ross! Stan Ross!
Stan Ross!
He's the boss!
He's the boss!
Say, Hall of Fame!
Hall of Fame!
Say, let him in! Let me hear it again! Let him in!
Bernie Mac became well-known through the Russell Simmons Deaf Comedy Jam on HBO and Spike Lee's film The Original Kings of Comedy. His other films include Bad Santa, Ocean's 11, Get on the Bus, and Booty Call. In 2002, The Bernie Mac Show won an Emmy for Outstanding Writing and a Peabody Award. Terry spoke with Bernie Mac in 2001.
You grew up on the south side of Chicago.
Yes, ma'am.
Describe where you grew up.
I was born on 66 and Blackstone, and that building was torn down because it was rat infested. We couldn't play outside because the rats used to be in the walls on the banisters. We stayed on the third floor, and my mom used to literally pick me up. I was 3 to 4 years old, and she would walk me three flights of stairs and kicking rats from my feet. The city tore the building down and moved us to 69th and Morgan. Well, that was a little bit better, supposedly, the Inglewood area in Chicago. And at 4 years old, that's when I, 4 to 5, decided I wanted to be a comedian because I walked in from playing and I saw my mother sitting in her favorite chair crying. And as a little kid, I saw her cry and I began to cry, like most kids often do. And I asked her why was she crying and she told me nothing. At that particular time, Ed Sullivan was introducing Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby came out and he did a routine about rats and snakes in the bathroom. My mother began to laugh and cry at the same time. When I saw that, I started laughing with her. And I told my mom, I said, that's what I'm going to be, Mom. I'm going to be a comedian. So I'll never have to see you cry again. Because at that particular time, I thought comedians relieve my mother of her pain. And that's something that I always wanted to do.
So what were some of the jokes that went over real big when you were a boy?
I think none. I think that I was a struggling comic, but in my mind, I was successful. People said I was stupid. I was silly. They said I was buffoonish. I used to dress up, put on my mother wig, put on my grandmother slip coat. I'd dress up as a woman and portray as Bernice. That was one of the characters that I created as a young boy, was Bernice. And it wasn't about being a homosexual or anything like that. I was portraying a woman. And I used to talk like a woman, put on my grandmother glasses, and I used to mimic, y'all better quit playing up in here. Everybody better go to bed. I'm sick and tired of all this mess. Lord, Lord, Lord. And that's how my grandma used to talk.
All right. Who were the comics you loved to listen to when you were growing up?
Sweetheart, I was a student of the game. I had so many. I mean, from Richard Pryor, Red Fox, Moms Mabley, Pig Meat Markham, Jack Benny, Red Skelton, Johnny Carson, Steve Allen. Oh, I don't want to leave anybody out. Jackie Gleason was one of my favorites. Norm Crosby, Don Rickles.
What did you do to try to figure out what it is that they did that was so funny? You said earlier that you tried to do impressions of comics that you loved when you were young.
I watched what made them different. I watched what made them all successful in their own way. And what made them all successful was style. They had a unique style about themselves, not like today. You see one comic and he gets hot, that's what they want everyone to be like. They want everyone to be like that individual. Don Rickles, I was so impressed with Don Rickles the way he can just come in and just destroy an entire room. That I was so impressed. And I was not offended as a young boy watching this guy and some of the things, Jews, blacks, Chinese, or I mean, he tore you up, but you knew it was a joke. I got it right away. I was not offended. I was not saying, did you hear what he said? He was funny. Jackie Gleason was so impressive to me, whereas he never rehearsed. He ad-libbed so well, and he took the energy that he had was something that I wanted. That's a page of his notebook that I've taken.
How did you figure out who you were going to be on stage as a comic?
I didn't figure it out until 1987. It's just something that came to me. I combined them all. Richard Pryor showed me how to laugh at yourself. That was something that was unheard of, to laugh at your pain. Red Fox was nothing but Richard Pryor, but he was denied. Richard Pryor modified and moderated Red Fox. Red Fox made 43-plus albums. That's a hell of a lot of jokes. But America wasn't ready for Red Fox. They said he was too blue. But Red Fox taught me how to be myself. Performing in High Sienna Hotel in Las Vegas, he told me, he said, you're a funny guy, but you don't want to be funny. You want to be liked. I didn't understand what he meant at that particular time. But being dedicated and finding out, it takes time. Because everyone kept telling me, especially being a minority, everyone kept telling me you had to be like Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby. Then when Richard Pryor got hot, oh, you ain't no Richard Pryor. Then Eddie Murphy came along. He had a 10-year draw period where there was no minorities, black comics, after Richard Pryor. Then Eddie Murphy came along. Everybody started telling me I had to be Eddie Murphy. Well, in 1987, I did a show in Chicago, and I was performing, and I wasn't at my best at that particular time, and a heckler kept heckling me. He was heckling everybody the whole entire night, and it was my turn. Everybody was really scared to go up because this guy was a big guy, big redneck. I mean, he had a table full of cats, and they were just intimidating everybody. Well, I went up, and I was not intimidated, and he said a few words. I kept trying to do my normal act. I got off my normal act, and I got on him, and the place went crazy. And it was more or less of being elated that I stood up to him, and my style changed at that particular time. Well, I got a standing ovation. The next night, I came back to work being my old self. And when I walked through the door before I performed that next night, it was a group of people that said, there he is. That's the guy I was telling you about, girl. He is funny. When did you see him tonight? Well, I went back to my old style. And everybody was looking at me like they was having prayer.
Comedian Bernie Mac speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2001 interview with comedian Bernie Mac.
Now, when you were getting started, did you play different kinds of audiences, some black audiences, some white audiences, some integrated audiences?
I performed whatever there was people. I started on the L's of Chicago. In the 70s, I used to ride the L's and perform from 95th Street all the way downtown. I used to do the subways.
Wait. Now, in New York subways have been almost like performance art, where every 5 minutes someone else is coming in and either doing some performance or asking mm-hmm. for money or telling you that they're, threatening you unless you give them money. But there's always something. So how would you do it? You just walk into a car and start
doing
your
act? No, I never walked to a car. No, I never did that. What I used to do was, during the rush hour, people go to work, I would get on the end of the L. And I would go and I would always watch the news and I would read the paper and see what was going on in the city. And I would get on and people would first look at me like I was a bum until they got acquainted with me and they got familiar with me. And they said, oh, this guy, this is the L comedian. And I used to make people laugh and I had a box. And people used to put money in the box. Then when I got to Lake Street, I should go way down in the subway, and as people be going back and forth, I would stand there, and I had this little microphone, little beatbox thing, and it was like my speaker, and I would tell jokes, and I would talk about current events, things that happened in the neighborhood, and plus I would do little characters and stuff that I had back then, and people would throw money in the box. I made $300 to $400 a day.
Wow, that's great.
But
it's probably more than some of the comedy cups played.
Yeah, but I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy at all because I felt like I was begging. I felt like a bum.
Right.
I wanted to be legitimized. In 1977, I went to the clubs.
Did you find that white audiences and black audiences reacted differently to your material or reacted differently in general?
Well, they act different in general because white audience come to be entertained. Black audience want to entertain you. And white audience are more cordial, more respectful of the artist. And even if you're bad, I mean, you know, the audience has changed. I'm talking about the audience back then.
Mm-hmm.
The audience has changed all the way around the table now. But white audience was more cordial to you. Black audience, they just tell you like it is. If you suck, you suck. And they don't want to hear. You ain't getting nothing but 2 or 3 minutes. You come out the gate with that old sorry stuff, you're in a world of trouble.
Well, how would you get driven off the stage if you weren't working?
I refuse to get driven off the stage.
Okay.
When I died the death of a pilot, I stayed up there. And that was something I think that helped me to this day. I see a lot of cats run. I seen that 3 minutes become an hour. I seen that hour, man, when you're on the road, be like 30 minutes. You be like, where did the time go? And that's a different transformation. Those are growing pains. You know, you have to work at your craft. You know, you don't come out hitting the ball right away. You might get a tip here and there. You know, I've done great for 2 weeks, and then a whole month when the slump may make nobody laugh. I've been through all of that.
Now, you opened for acts like Gladys Knight, The Temptations, The OJs. What's it like to open for big-name music acts? What were the pros and cons of that?
Well, the pros were that you made it, that you were on your way and you were pretty good to be there. The cons were, if you believe that stuff, you're in a world of trouble. You know, that's one reason why I don't hear the voices. You know, you can be up today and down tomorrow. Comedy is something that, you know, you have to really, really have it in your heart. Something that you just don't wake up and say you want to do or be. Comedy is something that's have to be in your bones because it's you against the world. In boxing, you have single activity, but a judge can determine your fate or a referee can stop the fight early. Tennis, hey, a bad call here and there can determine your fate. But comedy, you have no excuses. It's you and the mic and a bunch of people who don't give a doggone about you. And if once you get out there, you're on your own. And that's one thing that I love about comedy. I love that kind of pressure.
I guess the things that really made you famous were the Def Comedy Jam and the Kings of Comedy tour that Spike Lee made the movie of. So what was it like when things started to change and after the original Kings of Comedy was released?
Well, let me tell you exactly how it was. I made a name for myself in Chicago because I refused to go to Los Angeles because that's where everyone told me I had to go. So I made an oath to myself that L.A. was going to come to me. And I did that. I formulated a comedy circuit here. I went through the white club system, and I didn't make it. They told me that I wasn't funny. They told me I had to do this. The politics clicked in, and I was never a part of the clique. Well, I made a name for myself. I just started doing a little radio subbing in for Tom Joyner, Dub Banks on GCI V103. So I was working 7 days a week plus doing my regular working job. Then from there, all the comedy clubs started calling back for me. The black comedy clubs started to reopen. I started working both clubs. I got very popular in all the club circuit. Well, Def Jam came on, and they came in Atlanta City, and I was headlining 6 shows. Talent coordinator named Bob Sumner came to one of the shows. I had 3 shows that night, and he told me, he said, they've been calling me and told me they was doing a new television show, and they wanted me to come on. Well, he came to Atlanta, and he saw me, and he said, man, you are on. We want you on. I said, great. Then in 1997, they came to me with the Kings of Comedy. And what the Kings of Comedy did was it put me in an arena where a lot of people who didn't know me got to know me. We was doing 24,000, 18,000 seaters for 3 years. And that broadened my audience. And the rest is history.
You're in the remake of Ocean's 11, the new versions of it. Who do you play in it?
I play a character of the name of Frank Catton, who's a con man. I'm the cat that enabled everyone to get into the casinos, because I know the casinos like the back of my hand. I play as a car dealer. I'm a con man. But I get the maps, and I lay everything out, and I get us in and out of all these casinos, and that's my job.
Were you a fan of the Rat Pack, and specifically of Sammy Davis Jr.?
Oh, no
question.
No question. Troy Bishop, Peter Lawford, I mean, Sammy. I thought those cats were Dean Martin. Dean Martin had a certain suave about him that was indescribable. And honestly speaking, he sang better than Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra, I could think of a new one.
No, no way.
Oh, please.
No.
Frank Sinatra is overrated to me.
No.
But I like his persona. I like what he stood for, and I like the respect that he had offstage. His presence was more powerful than on. Frank Sinatra was mediocre to me. Andy Williams, Mel Torme, Dean Martin, I'll tear his tail up any day. Those were my favorites. And Dean Martin was funny. Dean Martin had a certain pizzazz about himself that was just unbelievable. Frank Sinatra just had that fasana. He had that that halo on him that people was afraid to touch. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think he's very talented. I love the Rat Pack, but that's just my personal opinion. That's my favorite. I can name some more. Barry Como, much better singer.
Now, you're my guest, so I'm not going to argue with you about Andy Williams being a better singer than Frank Sinatra.
Okay.
But if we meet on the street sometime,
you know what?
We'll talk more about it.
That's a beautiful thing. I got my candy. Oh, he is all right. And I tell you what, whenever you meet me, we got a debate.
You bet. I have strong feelings about Sinatra.
I bring in facts with me.
Okay, I've got strong feelings about Andy Williams, too. I never really liked him.
Okay, that's all right. But he'd be Frank. All right, baby.
All right.
Comedian Bernie Mac speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. He's starring in the new film, Mr. 3000.